Welcome to HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the top stories and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Saturday, May 16th, 2026, and this is episode number 398. We have a fantastic lineup for you today, covering everything from the shifting landscape of front-end web development to the philosophical implications of AI video generation.
We really do. Today, we are talking about a prominent developer moving away from Tailwind CSS, a hilarious but painful satirical piece about the NPM package manager, how frontier AI models are completely breaking cybersecurity capture the flag competitions, a new open source world model from NVIDIA for generating video, and finally, a deep dive into HTML lists that proves most of us do not know HTML as well as we think we do.
Let us kick things off with the front end. Julia Evans, who always writes incredibly thoughtful engineering blogs, posted a piece titled Moving Away from Tailwind and Learning to Structure My CSS. This one got massive traction yesterday, pulling in over 460 points.
It really resonated. Julia talks about how 8 years ago, Tailwind was a lifesaver for her because she didn't know how to structure vanilla CSS. It kept her from creating a chaotic mess. But recently, she spent a week migrating a couple of sites away from Tailwind back to semantic HTML and vanilla CSS, and she found it incredibly fun.
What is fascinating is that she credits Tailwind for teaching her how to structure CSS in the first place. She realized Tailwind gave her a system, things like a reset style sheet, a defined color palette, and a font scale. So she just took those concepts and applied them to plain CSS, using modern features like CSS variables, nested selectors, and CSS grid.
Exactly. And modern CSS has come so far. We have native nesting now, which removes a lot of the need for preprocessors. And she makes a great point about grid. She is using CSS grid for responsive design without needing a million media queries, which is something Tailwind actually struggles with out of the box. Plus, she was tired of hauling around a giant Tailwind CSS file without a build step or having to rely on complex build systems just to style a simple blog.
The Hacker News comment section on this was classic. It immediately turned into a debate on the merits of Tailwind. One commenter argued that Tailwind pushes developers into a CSS-first approach, resulting in what they called div soup, where you just throw meaningless containers into your HTML just to hang utility classes on them. They argued it makes you a worse web developer because you stop caring about semantic, accessible markup.
But of course, the Tailwind defenders came out strong. Another commenter, who leads a design system for a Fortune 100 company, pushed back hard. They pointed out that Tailwind frees you from naming abstractions that inevitably change. When you are building highly complex, responsive, multi-theme components, having the styles right there in the markup heavily reduces cognitive load.
Right. It is the old separation of concerns debate. Do you separate your technologies by putting CSS in one file and HTML in another, or do you separate by component? It seems like Julia is finding a happy medium, organizing her vanilla CSS strictly by component so they do not bleed into each other. It is a great read if you are feeling a bit of framework fatigue.
Speaking of fatigue, our next story hit a little too close to home for the JavaScript ecosystem. It is a satirical article titled, "No Way to Prevent This, Says Only Package Manager Where This Regularly Happens."
Oh man, this was brilliant. It's written completely in the style of The Onion. The article jokes about a devastating supply chain attack in the NPM registry, quoting a fictional senior engineer saying, "What can you do? This is just the price of building modern web apps." It pokes fun at how the JavaScript world relies on 40-level deep nested trees of unvetted packages maintained by anonymous strangers just to capitalize a string.
And it hilariously contrasts this with ecosystems like Go or Rust, where they have robust standard libraries and strict cryptographic verification, noting that they reported zero instances of a college dropout weekend project wiping out global logistics infrastructure today.
It is funny because it hurts. But the comments on Hacker News actually pivoted into a really productive discussion about mitigation strategies, specifically a concept called cooldowns.
Yes, I found this part so interesting. A commenter pointed out that most NPM or PyPI compromises are actually detected and taken down by the registry within a few hours. So if you just implement a cooldown, meaning your system ignores any package with a release date younger than, say, 1 to 3 days, you bypass the vast majority of these supply chain attacks.
Exactly. The malicious packages just burn themselves out before your build system ever tries to pull them. The commenter noted that PNPM actually added a 1-day cooldown by default recently. There was some debate, of course. Some people asked, does not that just move the problem 7 days down the road? If everyone waits, who is doing the detecting?
But the counterargument is that the detection is not usually done by end users getting infected. It is done by automated security scanning tools, or by the original maintainers waking up and realizing their account was compromised. Giving those automated tools a 24-hour head start to flag the malicious code before your production server blindly downloads it seems like a no-brainer.
It really does. It is a simple fix to a problem that feels incredibly overwhelming. Moving from web security to a different kind of security, let us talk about our third story. The title is Frontier AI Has Broken the Open CTF Format. This is a blog post by a cybersecurity researcher named Kabir.
Before we dive in, we should clarify what CTF means, because there was actually a highly upvoted comment thread complaining that the author never spelled out the acronym. In this context, CTF stands for Capture the Flag. They are competitive cybersecurity challenges where players hack into systems or decrypt data to find a hidden string of text, which is the flag.
Right, and Kabir, who is a highly ranked competitive CTF player, is calling time of death on the open online CTF scene. He says that with the release of models like Claude Opus 4.5 and the new GPT 5.5, the game is fundamentally broken. These models are now capable of one-shotting medium and even hard difficulty challenges.
It is wild. He explains that teams are now just building orchestrators using the CTF platform APIs to spin up an AI agent for every single challenge the second the competition starts. The AI solves the easy and medium stuff in minutes, leaving humans to only look at the absolute hardest problems.
He makes a really sad but profound point about what this does to the community. CTFs were not just a scoreboard, they were a ladder. They were how beginners learn the ropes. You struggled, you learned, you leveled up. Now, if you're a beginner, the scoreboard is dominated by people running automated agents. You are incentivized to just use AI before you have even built the security instincts that the AI is replacing.
And he completely dismisses the argument that AI is just like a chess engine for cyber. He points out that in competitive chess, engines are strictly banned during matches. They are used for training and analysis, not to play the game for you. If you gave every chess player an engine during a tournament, it would not be a measure of human skill anymore. It would just be an API spending contest.
The comments from the security community were largely in agreement, though a bit depressed about it. People acknowledge that while AI is an incredible tool for actual security work and research, it completely destroys the sport and art form of these open competitions. Organizers just can't build challenges fast enough or make them weird enough to fool the agents without also making them miserable for human players to solve.
It is a fascinating consequence of AI capability overhang. We always think about AI disrupting jobs, but it is also disrupting hobbies and competitive intellectual sports.
Speaking of rapidly advancing AI capabilities, our fourth story is about a massive leap in generative video. NVIDIA released SANA 1M, which stands for World Model. It is a 2.6 billion parameter open source model capable of generating 1 minute of 720p video.
Getting a full minute of coherent video out of an open source model of that size is a huge technical achievement. But what I loved about the Hacker News thread on this was that it almost completely ignored the technical specs and went straight into a deep philosophical debate about the future of media and video games.
Yes, the top comment was from someone struggling with the concept of world models from a gaming perspective. They brought up games by From Software, like Elden Ring or Dark Souls, where every single item, enemy, and piece of architecture is placed with deep, deliberate intentionality. They argued that games lacking this human intentionality feel dead and break immersion.
The commenter was worried that as we move toward AI-generated worlds, we are hurtling toward a future with less intentionality behind the things we experience. Everything becomes impersonal and noisy. It is the fear of being inundated with superficially plausible, yet completely hollow content.
Someone in the replies made a really great analogy. They compared generative AI tools to a microwave rather than a circular saw. They said a circular saw is a creator tool. You take raw material and make something out of it, limited only by your skill. But a microwave is just a finishing tool. You press a button to make things hot so you can consume them.
That is a harsh but interesting comparison. But another commenter pushed back, noting that we already have this dichotomy in gaming with procedural generation versus handcrafted environments. Both can fail if done carelessly. The counterargument is that when these AI tools get better control mechanisms, they will just become another way for artists to express intentionality, just at a massive scale.
It reminds me of the Gutenberg printing press analogy someone brought up. The printing press created a rapid rise in the amount of content, and most of it was probably not great. But the sheer volume meant that the absolute number of high-quality works increased too. The average quality might drop, but the ceiling of what a small, dedicated team can create might go through the roof.
It is a debate we are going to be having for the next decade, I am sure. All right, let us bring it back down to earth for our final story, a blog post by Frank Taylor titled, "You Do Not Know HTML Lists."
I love posts like this. We all write HTML, we all use unordered and ordered lists, but Frank dives into the deep cuts of the HTML spec. He talks about description lists, menu lists, and specifically focuses on how to build user control lists using native elements like select, option, and data list.
The data list element is the star of the show here. If you have ever tried to build an autocomplete dropdown or a suggested search field, you know it usually requires a heavy JavaScript library, but HTML has data list built right in. You just link an input field to a data list ID, and the browser handles the autocomplete UI natively. He even shows how you can pair a data list with a range slider to create labeled stops on the slider.
It looks like magic when it works, but the Hacker News comments quickly provided a reality check on why developers do not use these native features more often. Browser compatibility is still a nightmare.
Oh yes, several commenters immediately tested the data list examples on their phones and reported that it behaves terribly on mobile Safari. One person noted that the autofill bar only populates with the first three items and does not clear properly. Another pointed out that trying to disable an option group inside a select dropdown simply does not work on iOS.
And that right there is the tragedy of native web development. One commenter perfectly summarized the frustration. They said, "This is why we have a new class of developers that skip HTML and go straight to React. When you try to use the native HTML platform, you run into a dozen quirks and limitations across different devices."
Exactly. They pointed out that while building a custom dropdown in React might result in div soup, at least it is consistent. You know it is going to render and behave the exact same way on Chrome, Firefox, and mobile Safari. It's a shame, because the HTML spec is actually incredibly rich and accessible by default. But if Apple or Google implement it poorly on mobile, it becomes essentially useless for production.
It is a great full circle moment for today's episode. We started with Julia Evans moving back to vanilla CSS because the platform has finally caught up to her needs. And we end with HTML lists reminding us that the platform still has some incredibly frustrating blind spots.
It is the beautiful, messy reality of web development. And that is going to do it for us today on HN Pod.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to read any of the articles or dive into the comment threads we discussed today, you can find all the links in our show notes.
We will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories from Hacker News. Until then, keep building and have a great day.